Welcome to Looking at Lucasfilm, the podcast with a different perspective on the world of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and all of the other entities that George Lucas, Kathleen Kennedy, Dave Filoni, and Jon Favreau, and the rest of the team at Lucasfilm have dreamed up over the past 40 years. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill and my co-host Brian Gaughan, and I are recording this on Sunday, June 26, 2022. Brian, the very last episode of Obi-Wan Kenobi aired this past Wednesday, and Ewan McGregor and Kathleen Kennedy have both said they wouldn't mind a season two of this show, and we'll talk more in depth about that as well as the Obi-Wan limited series in the second half of today's show. But given the very careful job they did of threading the needle, I wonder how they'd go back to the well a second time.
Well, he could. There's nothing wrong with him leaving the planet, helping people. As we are establishing now, he left the cave, and now he's going to become part of the community. So I didn't know they could have done what they did with this one. It surprised the hell out of me. So, I mean, I'm very looking forward to see what the Brain Trust puts in mind for the next one.
We'll talk more at length about that second half of today's show. But first, the news. And news portion of this week's episode of Looking at Lucasfilm is brought to you by Storybook Destination, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. For a worry-free travel experience, please book online at storybookdestinations.com. On the, I want to say, actually, it was the episode before last, Brian, when you were doing your very thorough look back at this year's Star Wars Celebration, the full 3 days at
4 days.
The Anaheim Con. 4 days. Oh, can't even think about it. But we were kind of slippy slidey on some dates for things, and I wanted to be sure that we revisited that, because I think on the last show we were talking about Patty Jenkins' Rogue One project, where something that she was very, very passionate about because her dad was a flyer, and it was just like, okay, so when's that going to happen now? Because that they announced that with great huzzahs.
Yeah, good fanfare, that it was going to be, you know, like the new thing of, and then wasn't there one done by the woman who was going to do, who did Russian Dolls?
Oh, God, that's yeah. Right. Is that Acolyte?
Is that the Acolyte? Okay.
Not sure. But just to be clear here, folks, we now have a time frame for Patty Jenkins' Rogue One. Unfortunately, it's been pushed off by more than 5 years. Now scheduled for December of 2027. It looks like now the very first theatrical Star Wars film that we're going to get is going to be Taika Waititi's. But even that's not due till December of 2025. So that's more than 3 years out. But on the upside, we are getting a crazy amount of Star Wars stuff over on Disney Plus. I mean, again, for those of us who were, it's like, oh, I just got the last episode of Obi-Wan. Not to fret, the Star Wars Lego Summer Vacation with Weird Al Yankovic.
Now, do you know, is he going to do a song too? Or is he just a voice?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I do not have an answer for that, but I will.
Because it would be hilarious if he did like a Star Wars thing, you know. I mean, the best Star Wars song, Bill Murray, you know, the Lounge Lizard, nothing but Star Wars.
Did you ever see his, I want to say his Phantom Menace song, the American Pie riff?
Oh, yeah, or Yoda with Lola. Yoda.
Yeah,
Yoda. Yeah, so he's a big Star Wars guy, so yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, he's definitely in this space. But yeah, that's dropping on August 5th. Then on the other hand, Star Wars Andor, which we're going to talk about this in the second half, but you have some theories you want to share about the number of episodes that are being done of these things. But Star Wars Andor, that's 12 episodes.
Yeah, or 24, basically. I mean, they plan 24, so yeah, I've noticed that with when The Mandalorian started, it was 6 episodes. And I accepted that because I watch a lot of British shows, you know, Doctor Who, the Mysteries, etc. And a lot of the British series, they're either 6-hour episodes or 3-hour-and-a-half episodes. And I think that's might have been what they got, that might have been what the Star Wars and the MCU decided to do. But I don't know if I like that that's, you know, that's written in stone for them. But of course, like you just said, Andor, 12 episodes. Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. going to show that things may change if they have to. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do, Kevin Feige, a lot of it has to do with budget and mm-hmm. how WandaVision was 9 episodes, but they were shorter mm-hmm. episodes. So mm-hmm. that was still in the budget of, like, if there was 6-hour-long episodes. So we'll see. I mean, they can do whatever they want to do, but yeah.
The thing about Disney Plus is we are 2.5 years in at this point. I mean, they are, it's like, okay, people responded to this, they didn't respond to that. And I think in a weird sort of way, Star Wars Andor, it is kind of an experiment. Again, this is Tony Gilroy doing this one. And, you know, he's flat out said that, you know, the conceit of this show, which, as you mentioned, was developed as a 2-season show, was that it starts 5 years out from the events of Rogue One and then systematically marches right up until Rogue One. And what was the elevator pitch? I know it involved Mission Impossible. Was it Titanic meets Mission Impossible, yeah, or it was something to that effect?
I think so.
yeah. That's the other thing. When you drill down into the press releases for Andor, they say 12 episodes have been shot for season one, and they are now in development for season two, which is a polite way of saying, let's see how people respond to the 12-episode show.
Yeah.
If they like it, okay, we'll do the other 12. If, on the other hand, they're not huge fans, maybe 6, possibly.
Well, I have another fly in the ointment. We were talking about the Acolyte, and it seems like that's going to be 8 episodes.
There we go. Keeping us on our toes.
And that was, her name is Leslie Headland, who's doing that.
There we go.
And it also says she's going to do another Star Wars project, too. Later on, it doesn't say what year it is. This is all I get from Internet Movie Database. But it says that, you know, the Acolyte is there, but then also there's something later. It says untitled Star Wars project, Disney Plus Star Wars project. So maybe they liked what the Acolyte has been so far, so they're giving her something else to do.
Okay. That's what's interesting about Kathleen. People will come in. I mean, for example, the Rogue One pitch.
Yeah.
Where did that Star Plans come from? And backing into that story.
Well, I'm sure we're going to hear something at D23, too. Or maybe, hopefully, there'll be something at Comic-Con. But I definitely at D23, right?
Speaking of which, did you, and again, forgive me, we're moving into Marvel-us Disney territory here. But did you see where Marvel Studios is actually going back to Hall H?
Oh, are they going to do something?
The giveaway evidently was those light pole banners they have all over town in San Diego out ahead of Comic-Con. A number of them have She-Hulk on them. And so we've got a number of folks who have been to the previous shows are like, okay, the only other time that's happened is when Marvel's doing a giant Hall H show. And sure enough, 5 days later, the news dropped that, yep, we're coming back. Anyway, and speaking of also of coming back, we get season 2 of Star Wars The Bad Batch. That starts on September 28th of this year. And again, just to keep throwing us off here, Brian, that's 16 episodes.
Well, the first season was 16, too. So, I mean, maybe that's Filoni and maybe it's their magic number for animation. I mean, the everything is weird that has changed in, remember when you made an animated show, you wanted to at least get 90 so you could put it into, you know, and even a sitcom so you can put it into syndication. Nowadays, you're lucky if Netflix goes beyond 3 seasons because they have this thing that people won't watch more than 50 episodes of something.
Yeah, it's definitely algorithm-based programming decision-making, but we grew up in the age where it's like the Munsters did like 40 shows a season.
Yeah, Star Trek did 32. So yep. 3 seasons, we got 90 shows. But what if they did 22 episodes? We may not even have Star Trek because it wouldn't be enough for syndication.
As it was explained to me in the late 80s, early 90s, the magic number for syndication was 65.
Okay.
That then got you, I want to say you could strip the show, run it 5 nights a week. For 13 weeks in a row without a single rerun. And that was the magic number.
Okay.
But we're in a different world now, a binging world. And, you know, and you're right. You know, they evidently you get past 50 and it's like, okay, you're asking a lot of me. I have things to do. Anyway, getting back to the Star Wars limited series, which again, it seems to be where the franchise is living for a number of years leading up to our Taika Waititi film of 2023. We have 2025. Let me be clear about that. Season 3 of Mandalorian is supposed to drop in February of 2023, with the first season of Star Wars Ahsoka debuting later the same year. They're being a little vague at this point about when Ahsoka drops. Less certain is the debut date for Star Wars Skeleton Crew. You talked about hearing about this coming out of Celebration. Brian, this is the project with Jude Law attached to it, right?
Yeah, Jude Law and was it Jake Kasdan who was doing it?
I want to say yes, and they have mentioned that there are 4 kids in the cast, but this is not a kids show.
Yeah. It's probably like a Stand By Me meets Star Wars. Probably something like that.
Could be. All right. But again, all we have on regard to that show is late 2023. So maybe in the Bad Batch slot for next year. And then beyond that, we have Rangers of the New Republic, The Acolyte, Lando, and A Droid Story. And all of these are to be determined as to when they're going to drop.
By the way, Skeleton Crew is John Watts, not Jake's Kasdan. He's on something else. I don't want people to tweet us and say that we're don't know what we're talking about.
I hear that 4 and 5 times before breakfast. It's okay. Also worth noting, though, from Lucasfilm is next year, a long delayed, much postponed project, Indiana Jones 5 is going to bow on June 30th, 2023. So a year from this week. We'll finally get to see Indy again. And you saw the news this week in regard to John Williams, right? That he is planning on retiring after he scores Indy 5.
Yeah, I didn't even know what retiring is because he's already doing a couple days at the Hollywood Bowl this summer. And then he's going to do something with the Pacific Symphony too. So his retirement is different than most people's retirement.
Well, it's so funny you say that because I remember going to see him. I want to say it was 1980 to 1993. He took over for Arthur Fiedler as the director of the Boston Pops. And again, it was the whole notion of, you know, wow, this guy's everywhere. And he had kind of a problematic history with the Boston Pops. He was used to the session musicians he'd work with out in L.A. who were absolutely total pros. And I mean this in the kindest possible way. And I'm from New England. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts, so I'm allowed to say this about the musicians at the Boston Pops. But these were a lot of union guys who had been there forever. And it's like, what are you going to do to me?
Yeah.
And Williams, in the middle of his run with the Boston Pops, actually threatened to walk away because of discipline issues. The guys weren't rehearsing and showing up late. And it just, he thought it was very unprofessional. But anyway, I getting back to
John Mr. Williams.
Yep. He announces his upcoming retirement through interview he did with the AP Wire Service. And as part of this interview, he said, at the moment, I'm working on Indiana Jones 5, which Harrison Ford, who's quite a bit younger than I am, I think announced that this will be his last film. So I thought, well, if Harrison can do it, maybe I can do it too. You're a contemporary of mine. So you grew up watching television and seeing the name Johnny Williams.
Yeah.
Johnny Williams.
The first thing I think I remember was, not Fantastic Voyage, what was the submarine show?
Oh, Voyage to the Bottom of
the Sea. I think he did that, didn't he?
Well, I know he did Irwin Allen's Lost in Space, likewise Time Tunnel and Land of the Giants, but I had no idea. I was doing the research today. It's like he wrote the music or some of the music for the pilot of Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Did he write the theme? Is the theme his?
I don't know. I mean, you got to remember that, especially when you worked in television back in the day, you know, you were kind of a journeyman. It's like, okay, what do you need?
Oh, I see.
On the other hand, his career in television got off to, kind of a big controversial start. I mean, you know the story about the Heidi TV movie from 68, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that.
It was a big programming event that NBC had scheduled for a Sunday night. But they have gone to great expense to promote the fact that this thing will start at 7 o'clock East Coast time. Again, to tune in to watch the TV movie version of Heidi. But there's a football game going on between the
Super Bowl. Wasn't it the Super Bowl?
Nah, I think the Super Bowl is January.
Okay,
so this is November of 68. So it's between the Jets and the Oakland Raiders. And at this point, the Jets are ahead. But, they cut away to Heidi for the East Coast feed. And then inside of a minute, the Oakland Raiders score twice and pull ahead 42-32. And football fans, especially the New York market, are losing their minds because, like, what happened? Especially because they put a crawl at the bottom of the movie to update the score. Oh, by the way, Oakland won, 42-32. So for a time, John didn't include that on his resume
for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, it was Time Tunnel that I was thinking of, not Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. But he's done so much music. I mean, we know him for, of course, Jaws, which basically blew up his... But he was doing a lot of stuff before that.
He was. In fact, I was surprised in doing the research today that his very first Academy Award was for Norman Jewison's film version of Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, he adapted the music for that?
Yeah, from the Broadway musical. Okay. And but then, again, he has this working relationship with Irwin Allen. And so Irwin taps him when he does not just the Poseidon Adventure, but also the Towering Inferno.
Oh,
and,
right.
And then for this brief window of time, John is the master of disaster because Universal then hires him to do the score for Earthquake. But in that same window of time, he does the score for Spielberg's first real theatrical release, Sugarland Express, which doesn't necessarily do the numbers. But on the other hand, Spielberg so enjoyed working with Williams that when that very same year, he gets tapped to, okay, we want to do a movie version of Jaws. And that's the other thing. I had no idea, Brian, that things moved this quickly on Jaws, that the book, the hardcover, is published in February of 1974. And by May, the first week of May of that same year, they're in Martha's Vineyard shooting the very first scenes for the film version of Jaws. It's not even that a question at that point that it had become a beach read. It sold, like 5 million copies eventually. And in fact, in a lot of ways, Universal felt, hey, we made a great preemptive buy there. Because by the time the movie came out the following summer, I want to say June 75, is that right?
Yeah, it came out in June 75.
Yeah, but it's this best-selling book that everybody's read, and it's like, ooh, I want to see the movie version of this. And a lot of what made that movie so memorable was Williams' score.
Yeah.
He did all of this work in 74. We had Towering Inferno came out in 74. Earthquake came out in 74. Sugarland Express came out in 74. He gets tapped to work on Jaws in 74. This is the very same year that he loses his wife of 22 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And evidently, this is how he dealt with the grief. He threw himself into work. They had three kids, he and his wife Barbara. And in fact, Williams' son Joseph was the lead singer for the group Toto.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love Toto.
Anyway, that just Spielberg was so impressed, you know, with what John had done for Sugarland Express and Jaws, that when George Lucas is talking about this riff on Buck Rogers that he wants to make, Steven's like, oh, you got to work with John Williams. You know, he'll do a great job for you. And sure enough, Star Wars A New Hope has that amazing score that continues on today. And then you were mentioning at top of the show your love of 1941, but
yeah, the March of 1941 has got to be one of the best. And I've heard it done by a college band one time, and it just blew me away. But I got a cute little story about Jaws. Jaws is my second favorite movie, and I've seen it so many times. And if somebody asks me what a movie's about, I say, well, there's this movie, and I always add Jaws. But anyway, I would want my kids to see it when they were young because I thought, you know, it'd be okay. But for some reason, every time I wouldn't tell them I'm playing the movie, I'd start up the movie, and then you'd hear, da-dunt, da-dunt, and they both run screaming out of the room. They didn't even know what it was. They just knew that did not warrant something good was coming, and it wasn't until they were in their teens that I got them. I went to a movie theater and showed it to them, and of course they share my love for Jaws as well. But that theme, just the dun dun dun, not even knowing what movie it was, they knew this is not good. I'm out of here, and they were like maybe 6 and 4 or something.
But I think you've hit upon something that fascinates me about the scores that John Williams writes for movies, because it's literally tell me how to feel.
Oh yeah,
you hear those notes from Jaws, you get a dread. You know, on the other hand, the
Powders,
you know, wonder or just think about Superman you know, in 1978, and what a hodgepodge of a movie that was. But that score, that majestic, heroic score, was the glue that held that movie together.
Even the song in the middle, you know, Can You Read My Mind? It was great. Yeah. It was like, it was wonderful until you grew up and going, really?
Yeah.
But when you were a 15-year-old, okay, Superman's in love. This is what would happen, you know, that type of thing.
John Williams has really provided the soundtrack of my life. I mean, the Raiders March or the E.T. theme, or for that matter, when you think about the hit, giant scene from space size hits, you know, things like Home Alone or Jurassic Park or the Harry Potter series, where so much of what made those movies work, you know.
Well, one of my favorite scores from, actually, Alfred Hitchcock, of course, used in all his films Bernard Herrmann. And I guess they had a falling out. So Hitchcock's last film, Family Plot, Williams did the score for that with harpsichord, of course. And it was great. But I remember the one I bought and I wore out was Brian De Palma's The Fury. Which was basically a Bernard Herrmann score. And it freaked me out to the, I couldn't stop listening to it. That and The Omen that year were the two that I wore out the records. And it fit so well into the movie too, just like it fit into Jaws. I mean, a lot of people, my wife, who is a classical violinist, she will say, oh, John Williams got that from Ravel, or he took that from Stravinsky, or whatever. And yeah, you can find the original pieces that he kind of took from, but it's just like making a variation of something or a cover. And he fits it perfectly in the movies. He, you know, all his soundtracks. I mean, if they don't have a theme, they have something that goes through the movie that just takes you through the movie. So, I mean, it's something at the beginning, and then it takes you out at the end.
And very, very true. So, just in case you folks are wondering, John has been nominated for 52 Academy Awards. And as we mentioned, he took one home for Fiddler, and then had over, dear Lord, the 7 decades he's been writing music for film and television. He took up 4 more. And there's stuff that maybe you don't know he wrote. Like, for example, theme for the Today Show, likewise NBC Evening News and even Meet the Press, that he wrote a piece of suite of music for NBC called The Mission that they've been using ever since they commissioned it in 1985. And
the Olympic, the 84 Olympics, too.
Yeah, yeah. So he turned 90 this year. And as you mentioned, John seems to have a very different idea of how one relaxes in his 90s. Are you going to go to the bowl to catch any of the concerts?
Yeah, I'm going
to.
It's great because he used to do the whole concert, even before and after intermission. Now David Newman does like a masterclass. He'll do, he'll talk about other movies and other composers and stuff, including his uncles and his cousin.
Of course,
And it really is great listening to him do, and then John comes out and there are lightsabers galore. The whole Hollywood Bowl is filled with lightsabers. And when they start playing the Imperial March, they just, those sabers are moving. And it's really great. I've seen him at the Hollywood Bowl probably about 10 times. And I've heard my favorite themes of his played, including Schindler's List with Isaac Perlman played.
You're killing me.
No, it was really great. And just things that you don't think that he did. He'll play like, he got nominated for this one too. The Angela's Ashes, which is one of the most depressing films you've ever seen in your life. Mm-hmm. And he does that. He just does he'll just sneak in these things that people are going, what's that from? But that's where, when I discovered the Cowboys, even though I had seen the Cowboys before, I never knew that he did that.
That's 72, right?
Yeah.
The John Wayne.
Wayne, yeah. So I'm looking at what the ones he won here. He won for Jaws.
Right.
And he won for Star Wars. And he won for E.T.
Wow, that's quite the run.
Which I would say are 5 of the best soundtracks ever written. Mm-hmm. Or 4 of them.
It kind of makes me sad that he's stepping away, but after 7 decades, 90 years, old, the man definitely deserves a break. And speaking of breaks, when we get back from this break, Brian and I are going to talk about episode 6 of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Something else we should have mentioned, Mr. Williams, in addition to obviously working on all of the Star Wars films in various roles, and also, didn't he also contribute a Obi-Wan theme to the Obi-Wan?
Yeah, I guess Obi-Wan was the only one he never wrote a theme for. So when Kathleen Kennedy say, listen, he's written every theme for every character, would you write it? And he said, absolutely yes. And he premiered it at Star Wars Celebration.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And with a full orchestra. And it was wonderful. It was great to hear. And now, of course, now it's familiar to us. But and it works. It's more of of where the other themes, like the Imperial March and stuff, which basically is Vader's theme. It's an action where this is basically almost a person's life. And when he did it, he just didn't do the theme. He did this whole suite, which you could almost see Obi-Wan's life going through this piece of music. It was more of a concerto or a piece than it was just a theme to something.
Dang, I gotta check this out. Speaking of Star Wars related things that Mr. Williams wrote, he also wrote the theme for Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, the land at Disneyland and at Disney's Hollywood Studios in Florida. Yeah, which, by the way, Galaxy's Edge was in the news this week, not for a great reason. There was a gentleman who posted over on Reddit he had been to Disneyland Park, evidently trying to experience Rise of the Resistance, the ride that you loved so much,
yes,
Brian. But evidently, in one day, he was evac'd off of this thing 3 separate times. That they
He never got all the way through the ride. It would break down at one point or another. No. Yeah.
Was this Disneyland or Disney World?
I want to say Disneyland.
Okay.
And that, I guess, for me, has always been my one complaint about Rise of the Resistance. It is the most elaborate attraction with, you know, if you think about how many different ride systems are incorporated into this thing. It just reminds me of, there's that great line from Star Trek, The Search for Spock, where that they're stealing the Enterprise and I forget, what is the name of it? Oh, the Excelsior is going to chase after them. But it breaks out outside of a space dock. And I think at that point, Scotty turns to Captain Kirk and hands him like three little parts. And it's like, what did you do? And it's like, well, you know, the more elaborate you make the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the drain. And that was the thing. I feel like with this super deluxe elaborate attraction, it's just, there's so many things that have to work. And if it doesn't, one element doesn't work, the ride has to shut down.
Well, it seems that they're getting more complicated on all rides. Isn't Hagrid's, isn't that roller coaster now half the thing it used to be? And we don't even have to talk about the Bigfoot in the Himalayan ride. I mean,
yeah, I mean, Hagrid's, I think, is a different, well, you know, but what's kind of interesting in both of these cases, you're talking about roller coasters with show scenes.
Oh, right.
You talk with people in ops, it's like, well, even when the Yeti doesn't move, or even when an animatronic breaks down on Hagrid, it's still a roller
coaster. Still a roller coaster, yeah. Okay.
You know, so it's like we can still get, you know, you still go fast. You still, you know, you still get thrilled. It just, the Yeti doesn't weigh it to you.
You know, actually, I wouldn't mind going into Ride of Resistance and have a breakdown. And I would love to see how they're going to, like, push me out. I mean, those the people who are part of the New Order, I mean, mm-hmm. I bet they stay in character. And they just, it's like they're putting you to prison. Move. Everybody stay in one line.
Yeah.
That could be fun to see.
That's intriguing. Okay. I tell you what, if any of our listeners have actually gotten evac'd off of Rise of the Resistance, how do they do it? Is it the cast members who are dressed as the First Order, or do you get actual garden variety? Cast members are like, I'm sorry, it didn't work. Get out. So, all right. But speaking of things that did work, Obi-Wan, final episode.
Wow.
I was worried about the dismount here, Brian. Just because we already know what happens in New Hope when Darth Vader and Obi-Wan get back together. First of all, when they're on the Death Star, Obi-Wan does not call him Anakin. Obi-Wan calls him Darth. And that was always kind of a, well, wait a minute, you know, especially now that we know the prequels and we know the history of the characters and that sort of thing. Why would you call him Darth? And of course, Episode 6 handles that moment quite well, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They handle that moment. They handle the idea of why Darth does not continue to pursue him.
In a weird sort of way, have you ever heard Seth MacFarlane's take on the Emperor over on Robot Chicken?
Yes.
Okay, so I kind of got that vibe, that Seth MacFarlane vibe, you know, coming off of this version of the Emperor. It's like, you know, we'll track him down to the ends of the earth. Like, well, wait a minute, are you working for me or even the Obi-Wan Kenobi hunting business?
Yeah, yeah, so that kind of, maybe that's where they got the idea. But like you said, I was a little wary of the dismount only because I thought episode 5 was so full of everything, you know, and that it could have been the end there too. But it continued, and the fight, as you see, Vader is still hacking, maybe because of his robotic arms and stuff, but Obi-Wan was in perfect shape. I mean, he was doing rolls, he was doing flips, he was doing the whole thing. And Obi-Wan was the better swordsman. He was, he still had, you could tell that this was still him being the master.
What I love about the construction of these 6 episodes, I remember we had that protracted fight back on where the Jedi Council is located.
Corsicant?
There we go. Thank you. And you got to see, and again, you were the one who talked about, you know, from the first episode going on, it's like, this is a broken man. This is a guy who, you know, that whole scene in the desert where the Jedi seeks him out. And it's like, you know, go bury your lightsaber in the desert and walk away. You know, that the battle's over. We lost. And just over the arc of the story, we watched, this is a guy who came back to himself.
Well, you saw it in the way he, like in episode 5, he became the general again.
Yes.
You saw him, well, actually it was episode 6 when he left the thing. You saw at the end where, remember he was living in the cave? Mm-hmm. He was living away from everybody. Now he left the cave.
Yep.
And he ends up where, probably near Anchorhead, where he was before, or where he was in A New Hope. And it shows his confidence, and Ewan McGregor did a wonderful job.
He did. There was a genuine arc.
Arc, yeah. I mean, when you saw him most broken was when they were on the mining planet, and the stormtroopers were asking him why he called her Leia, and he was devastated. You could see it in the way he was. He was more of a broken man, and he was ready to give up, but he didn't. And he just said what basically was true. She reminds me of her mother. And it was so devastating, but that showed that he was continuing. And the way he would just talk back to Leia and just was not the person that we saw in the prequels. And he just had to get there, too. And it wasn't just Leia who got him out of the shell. It was Roken. It was Talia. It was the fake Jedi. All these people brought him back. It was almost like the Odyssey for him. He just met all these people that brought him back to where he should be. And even at the very end where he and Owen, and then the end. I'm glad that we told our people out there what hello there means.
yes.
Because some of them who didn't know, like us, would have been very like, what the heck is this coming from?
What I loved were those sorts of buttons where it did. I mean, I get there are people who get upset at fans. But for example, the battle with Vader, and when he cracks open the helmet.
So now
we do in fact get to see Hayden Christensen, and I think again you sent me the note. I hadn't seen the episode yet, but it's like, yep, you get to hear his voice. But the way they would toggle, you know, especially toward the end, but they toggle back and forth.
Back and forth was great because that gave Obi-Wan. I mean, Anakin was there. Mm-hmm. But then it was Vader.
Yeah.
And he said at the very end, I'm out of here. We're gone. But also it was very, when Anakin said to him, it wasn't your fault. I killed Anakin. Was that Anakin saying that? Because he was basically absolving Obi-Wan from all that happened.
But at the same time, to look at the genuine heartbreak that Ewan, you know, put into Obi-Wan at that moment, and goodbye, Darth, literally acknowledging my friend is gone, but still saying goodbye to Darth Vader. By the way, the other thing, and again, I know this is fan service, but the whole notion of when he hit him with the lightsaber and in the head, it caused the wound that we see finally. Yeah. In Return of the Jedi. I mean, it's just like, I get that there are people who are upset. You know, they feel like that sort of stuff is spoon feeding. But I like it when it all links.
Oh, I like it, you know, too. I mean, of course, because again, it's fan service, but it's also an Easter egg. And as you and Aaron talked about the MCU universe and the Easter eggs, don't we, isn't that what we live for? Don't we live for, you know, seeing a droid we've never seen before and, or we have seen before and just saying, oh yeah, he was in episode three or that person was in Clone Wars or, you know, or the reference to that person and stuff like that's what we live for. That's why we love these shows.
But okay. Now, again, want to say here, spoiler, if you have not seen episode six yet, there's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful spoiler in the very last seconds of this thing where we get Liam Neeson coming back as Qui-Gon. And I love that they had showed Obi-Wan numerous times for this episode trying to reach out to Qui-Gon. And after he's found himself again and after he's, you know, gotten that wonderful moment with Owen, you want to meet him? And just sort of riding off into the desert to, you know, start his new life and the whole notion of, why now? And it's like, well, you weren't ready to see, you know, and then the whole, okay, come on, we got a long way to go yet. But there's this wonderful quote from the Hollywood Reporter interview that Liam Neeson did about, well, why'd you come back? And he said, well, I certainly didn't want anyone else playing Qui-Gon Jinn. And, you know, I wanted to show my respect to George Lucas and the mythical world that he created. And plus, Ewan McGregor is a pal. And I loved working with him back on Phantom Menace 25 years ago. And it's just, again, that's the sort of thing you want to hear. And then the last little bit of connective tissue where Leia is back on Alderaan and dressing, you know, because they're going to meet a dignitary and you know, earlier on the ship, you know, as a parting gift, Obi-Wan gives little Leia a holster. And you
know, Talia's holster.
There we go. Talia's
holster. Because you know that the hashtags in Talia holster was every person she saved.
I didn't notice that, but that's a lovely touch.
Because that's what she would say. She said, when I saw what happened to this one family, I decided I didn't want that anymore. And she showed the hashtags and she goes, every hashtag is for a person I saved.
But I love the little exchange. Yeah, an empty altar. Yeah. It's like, you're 10. I'm not giving you a blaster. You know, but just the, you know, the whole notion of, you know, what Leia is dressing to visit the dignitary.
Was a great callback.
That was a great callback. But also the fact that, you know, she uses it for Lola, you know, or at least she uses it for Lola now because eventually she's going to get her blaster. But
what I thought was strange, too, it was almost a throwaway, is when Obi-Wan finds Lola in his pocket. And then he puts her on the dash of his ship. Lola is not used at all. So it's almost like going against Chekhov's gun theory. But did it have to be? Maybe it was Leia saying, I'm still with you. You're with me. I'm with you if I give you Lola. So maybe that was like a motivation for him also. I still have to save Leia. I still have to save Luke. If he beats me, he will find out. So maybe something like there was more to it. Also, I just wanted to point out that nowhere, maybe on Internet Movie Database after it was out, but nowhere is Liam Neeson given a credit. So I guess they wanted to keep it such a secret that they didn't even tell the people who did the credits that he was in it, so it would not even attempt to leak out.
That is cool. I did not notice that. And of course, we're doing all this talk, but we haven't talked at all about Reva's arc in this show, or for that matter, where she gets left off.
I thought was when we first saw her, and the guy was bullying the water guy, and she pushes him out of the way. It was almost like her two worlds were coming together. It was almost like she was still an inquisitor. She was still in charge, but she was still helping too. And did you notice when she took off her hood, her hair was not in that tightness. It was like scraggly in the back. Like she was now a broken person. And she needed to justify what she was doing from the beginning. And I guess that justification was take out Darth's kid. But I don't know. I think if she told Darth Vader it was his kid, that probably would have been more of a diss. But that whole sequence between her and Beru and Owen, oh my gosh, they have no powers, yet they were throwing things at her like they had the Force and throwing them. And it was just, it was a remarkable, like what people will do when they, when they're put in a corner.
We've seen Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. We, you know, we've only seen them at a couple of moments in the series to date. And we've, you know, in New Hope, so, you know, Owen, you know, grumbling
right.
Beru about dealing with this kid. This is the first time we've actually seen them protect the child.
Yes.
And put themselves in harm's way. I know that's fan service, but at the same time, it's a great thing to add to the tapestry. That this epic saga that we know is the Skywalker saga. And I love that. I think the very first time you and I talked about the Obi-Wan Kenobi limited series, you just zeroed in on Reva, and it's like, there's a story there, and I'm going to love to see what they do with this character going forward.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure that she's going to, if they do a series with her, which I really hope they do, I'm thinking she's got to connect with Roken, and she's got to be one of these people. I mean, isn't there a character in the comic books or called Raven or Reven?
I have been reading about this just over the past day or so, that a Sith, a Jedi that became a Sith that then went back to being a Jedi.
Okay. I mentioned this to Devin, and he was very upset. He goes, oh no, Reven is Reven. You gotta bring Reven into it. You can't make Reva Reven. But you could still make her this, you know, person going out there and basically rescuing. And that could be a serial. It could be an episodic show. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be a movie like this one is. It would be episodic. It would be like, you know, The Equalizer or The Fugitive or anything like that. Oh, The Fugitive. It could be very much like The Fugitive.
I think you're onto something there. Okay, so very much enjoyed all six episodes. Obi-Wan Kenobi, I think they did, there's a part of me that's still, I know it's got to be out there somewhere, the script, but the feature film version.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, because again, I
heard the original bad guy was was going to be the other Darth Red guy.
Darth Maul?
Darth Maul, yeah. That he was going to be the original one, and because of Mandalorian, they said, no, let's make this the biggest one. So that's why they went to, which doesn't make sense to me, because isn't that what Obi-Wan's all about? If him and Vader?
Didn't Filoni deal with Darth and Obi-Wan in an episode of Star Wars Rebels that I thought it actually had some amazing writing?
Well, he did. Yeah. Well, no, it was Obi-Wan. Yeah, in Rebels. Not Rebels. Mm-hmm. It was Obi-Wan and Maul.
Right.
Where he takes out Maul. And Ahsoka was the one who finds out that and almost in the same way, too, cutting off. I mean, he's lost a lot of helmets to, you know, ex-friends. Mm-hmm. But, you know, messing up half his face where she realizes it's Anakin again. Mm-hmm. So I think she was the first person to find out that he was, except I guess now we know that Reva knew it was Anakin too.
Well,
but I just love it because it's all falling back on itself. It's like a snake eating itself. It's just, it all goes in the circle, and they try their best, and maybe they have to stretch it a little bit. But for the most part, they keep us continuity wise. It doesn't upset me at all. I've loved Star Wars from day one. I love what they do. There's nothing that's bothered me. I mean, except for the first episode of Boba Fett, but we can get into that later. But other than that, it's just, I don't know, maybe I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I don't think any of these films or TV series or anything are done for people to put their own agenda in, not even Ryan's. You know, I think what it is they want to make the best possible Star Wars films to continue what George did. George wanted to make a world that was acceptable, that was good versus evil, but you knew who was who, and that good would win. And that's what George wanted, and I think that's what everybody else is basically taking that mantle and continuing with it.
Okay, thank you. Summed it up quite nicely there. So, and speaking of summing up, folks, this brings us to the end of another episode of Looking at Lucasfilm. If, on the other hand, you're enjoying, you know, Brian's insights when it comes to all things Star Wars, you know, that Brian has opinions on all sorts of things, and you can find out about them on social media.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Geek with Children, and you spell children CHILDRN. So that's where you can find me and my opinions, which my wife makes me keep to myself. So.
Okay. On the other hand, if you want to see what Nancy and I are posting on Twitter, you can head over to Twitter and Instagram, where they're under Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Let's see, beyond that, I want to remind you we have a couple of other podcasts here. We got Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. Likewise, we have Marvelous Disney, which I do with Aaron Adams. Likewise, Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor. That's going to do it for this week. I want to thank you for listening, and Brian and I will be back with a brand new show in 2 weeks' time. Till then, take care.